Este café.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please the court, Michael Cook for Thomas Zingas. So, Your Honor, based on what you'd asked for earlier, we're going to kind of stick to the things that we disagree with. And then I think clarify, I think there's one more point that we do agree on between myself and the state. A lot of what transpired earlier today had to do more with what's going to transpire, I think, going forward in this case. And I'll leave that largely to the Bar Association. They're really here to see if we can find a resolution to this going forward for both, as Mr. Gold has pointed out in the past, both the defense bar and the prosecution bar. They don't represent one side or the other. So they're probably in the best place to answer some of those questions. Although I did have I know the court asked, before I forget, one thing about is the blood alcohol amount on the complaints. The complaints are just ordinary tickets. They just generally say the statute number, the 450 statute number. They do not have the blood alcohol. In fact, we do tend to go through a fair amount of effort to not have that before the court, because it's evidence, you know, it's beyond the mere accusation. And it's something that the court would have to find as a matter of fact if it did try it. What we didn't speak about was the burden of proof at trial of the state in a 450 trial. So one, in the case of a second or subsequent DUI, the state does have to prove the existence of a prior DUI. That's usually easily enough done by entering a certified copy of the driver's abstract into the record, and then that abstract would indicate if there was a DUI inside a 10-year period. This is generally a step down if it's been more than 10 years. The issue here is that for that 10-year period, the abstract is just no longer reliable. And I'll point you to Rule of Evidence 802C8, the last paragraph. The exception to entering a public record into evidence without it being hearsay is if the source of information or other circumstance indicate that such statistical findings are not trustworthy, then it does not. It's not something that could be put into evidence. In this case, there is thousands to tens of thousands of records in that period that are potentially incorrect. So now the state in the trial, Mr. Zingas, did not enter into evidence any proof regarding the prior. If they had entered the abstract, it would be faced with the evidentiary issue. And in that case, trying to resolve that matter, trying to cure that problem of the abstract, they also did not enter any evidence into the record that indicated that Mr. Zingas was not affected by the Trooper Dennis cases. It might be the case, certainly going forward, that the appropriate way to deal with these old cases is to do these PCRs, but that in this case did not obviate the state's responsibility to put on its case. It's not the defendant's burden to disprove their culpability under the law. It's not the defendant's burden to necessarily to go and do a PCR ahead of time. That burden is on the state, was both set forth by the appellate division below and by Judge Fall in his voluminous report. Excuse me. The state had their opportunity to offer that evidence. They did make an attempt, but it was a reference to a screen grab that was not previously provided to the defense as it's meant to be under Rule 807. We didn't have an opportunity to observe, to look at it, and to determine if we had any objection to it. In fact, that did not happen until we went through the special master hearings this past summer. As the state has indicated, they basically instructed the municipal courts not to provide that information for, you know, reasons that I appreciate, but.
Can you clarify us precisely what they put in support of the burden they had?
My understanding was what he represented was a screen grab of some list. I can make assumptions about it, what it was, but I saw it sort of, I then objected and said, well, you'll have to, that this is not sufficient. I renew my objection to this going forward without, you know, evidence of, you know, that the list. I objected based on what Judge Lisa's order said. And I acknowledge that even the appellate division below said that Judge Lisa's order was no longer valid because the Cassidy litigation that was done, but made the same argument that the appellate division made. You know, this is what makes sense. You know, the rationale is not any less valid. The rationale set forth both in the order and in the analysis of the state in their memo to the prosecutors that, you know, documentary evidence is what's required to prove this, given the deficits within the abstract. So, you know, I did look at it, but I only saw it as I was standing there during the sentencing.
Go back a step.
Sure.
Did they introduce an abstract?
They did not.
Just the screen grab you're referring to, and can you tell us generally what it contained?
I honestly don't recall. I have a guess what it must have been. It must, you know, but I don't have a recollection of it as I saw it for a moment, and it ended up, not, it was 4 years ago, and it ended up, I assume it was a page from the list that the state, you know, that the state circulated to the prosecutor, to the prosecutors. But again, they also didn't move it into evidence.
Sorry, you said usually a prior conviction is proven just by entering the driver's abstract, correct?
Yes.
But there was no driver's abstract here?
There was not one entered into evidence. I believe there was discussion of it. It was a representation made by the state.
What was the representation?
That this is a second out of Collinsworth.
So that might be a whole separate issue, that there was no evidence of any, you're saying there was no evidence of any prior conviction put into the record, period. So even having absolutely nothing to do with Mr. Dennis, you're saying in this case, there was no evidence of any prior conviction entered into the record.
I think you mean with regard to Mr. Zingas, you mean?
No, Mr. Dennis is the calibrator. So that's
correct. So yeah.
I'm saying even if there had been no issue with Mr. Dennis, he had never existed, there was never any calibration issue ever. You're saying here there's this fundamental, totally separate problem in that there was no prior record of conviction entered at all.
Correct.
Other than the representation of the prosecutor, right?
Correct.
You had objected to?
That was objected. Well, that. I would have to look at the record.
That's one thing.
I would have to look at the record, but the bigger issue was I did object to the representation made about the list, the Zingas list. I will call it the Cassidy list. For a while. And when I say Cassidy list, I mean whatever list that they were referring to that they purported showed that my client was not a Cassidy case.
That's assuming there is a prior conviction that has been entered into the record, and you are challenging whether or not it can be used in this case, correct?
Correct. And part of the issue is that this was a list that was made at the behest of, once the issue arose, this list was made at behest of the Attorney General's office, a request to the state police. They produced a list, sent it to the Attorney General's office. They did some things to it. They sent it to AOC to get, I'm sorry, the court office to get the addresses. There was another issue with regard to the addresses. It came back from the court office with in a spreadsheet with multiple sheets. There was one sheet that showed what they thought was a higher relationship between the cases and the names and addresses, and the second sheet that they were a little less sure of. And
regardless of any issues with the list, in this case, Judge Fall explicitly found that your client provided a breath sample, an AlcoTest instrument ARUM0042, and that AlcoTest instrument ARUM0042, quote, is not an instrument that was calibrated by Sergeant Dennis. Are you arguing that that factual finding is not supported by substantial evidence?
Now? No, my argument is and I think Judge Fall sort of couched it in this sense, was there would have been an ability to go into these two databases that exist and find that information out and provide it and put it into evidence at the time, and that did not happen.
But you are agreeing that the AlcoTest instrument that your client provided the sample on was not calibrated by Sergeant Dennis, or you're not challenging Judge Fall's factual finding that it was not calibrated by Sergeant Dennis?
At this point, within the scope of what we're talking about here, no, I do have other issues with it, but that's sort of beyond what we're doing here.
It sounds like what happened at trial was the focus was placed on the Cassidy-Dennis issue.
Correct.
And that counsel together sort of glossed over, either with an agreement or without an agreement, on the abstract and the representation that this was a second offense. Is that a fair characterization?
I don't think we glossed over it. I think it was not what we were really concentrating on.
Right. So what you've said so far, and I just want you to correct this if I'm mistaken. The prosecutor stood up and said, Judge, I represent, this is a second offense. There's a prior DWI. And you do not recall any objection being leveled or anything further on that point?
No, I don't think I explicitly objected to the representation that there was a prior.
My understanding is that the defendant had moved in municipal court to be sentenced as a first-time offender, arguing that the judge should disregard the 2012 BWI conviction because the state failed to produce documentary evidence that the 2012 conviction is not based on an AlcoTest breath sample test rendered inadmissible by Cassidy. The judge denied the motion and sentenced him as a second-time offender.
That's accurate.
So, counsel, oftentimes, in this case, the municipal court and the law division both imposed a sentence as a second offender. Oftentimes, judgments will be affirmed as modified. Does this fall in that category? The description of Judge Fall's findings that Justice Winter Apter just read would be a modification. Is that an appropriate way to look at this? And if not, why not?
So the state had a burden to produce this evidence at trial. Add this evidence back into the case, I think, raises the sort of double jeopardy concerns that we were discussing earlier, but obviously in a different way. You know, the state had their opportunity. I don't want to go too far afield, but just to explain a little bit of what happened on the ground that I do recall, the conviction was in December. The court, for reasons of case volume, decided to adjourn it for sentencing, and that was done in January. We had some time to discuss it before. I did indicate that I had this objection on that day of. I did indicate I had this objection on the record when we first convened on the, I believe it was January 8th. The court gave the state the opportunity to go and see if they could find some information to help cure the issue. And the state was you know, unable. They had an opportunity to bring something in that was, you know, in admissible form, and they did not do that.
This wasn't at, you said trial earlier, but this wasn't a trial. This was at the sentencing argument, correct?
This was at the sentence. Yes. So it was bifurcated. It ended up being bifurcated just because of scheduling concerns. The trial as to the facts of, you know, of guilt were, was done, I believe it was the 20th of December, and then the sentencing was adjourned to the 8th of January the following year.
Could the judge have relied on an abstract that the court produced in order to make the determination as to a second offender without the state formally admitting it as a piece of evidence at sentencing?
I believe they could have done a, I mean, it's an abstract, it's a fairly well-known thing to the attorneys. It's something that they could have found judicial notice of.
Oftentimes that's what happens, right? The clerk will print out the abstract, the judge will take a look at it, discuss it with the parties and decide how to sentence.
Sometimes it's on the screen, yeah.
Right, so if in this case, the appellate division vacated the sentence, there is no sentence right now, correct? So,
right.
So if the matter is sent back for resentencing either way, why wouldn't the prosecutor have the opportunity to then rely on the abstract or the court rely on the abstract to determine the second sent the second DWI, taking into account the Dennis factors now?
Well, I think that would have been appropriate at the time to take judicial notice of it. But again, it's still something the state would theoretically have to proffer. I mean, the evidence is generally comes from the parties, and the judge does what the makes its determinations. The finder of fact makes their determinations.
But why did the state not proffer the evidence that we spoke about how your client provided a sample on an Alco test instrument ARUM0042 that was just not calibrated by Sergeant Dennis on a retrial, as Justice Noriega just suggested? So it's going to have to be, let's say it was remanded. A resentencing. Why could the state not proffer that evidence then?
I'm not certain to understand why they would have an opportunity to retry it. I mean, he was
not retried, just resentenced.
Or resentence it. I'm not seeing that, but you know, he was sentenced at the time that the state had ample opportunity to provide the information that they needed to prove his prior DUI. I also don't see it as solely a sentencing issue in the sense that it's not quite Apprendi in the sense that there's a first has a certain range of sentencing. A second DUI is a certain range of sentencing. A third is a certain range of sentencing. It's not precisely a range of sentencing. It's more of like three different, even though a lot of the facts are the same, it's really three separate definitions of the crime. So,
but Apprendi seems to take account of that. It specifically holds other than the fact of a prior conviction. Any fact that increases the penalty has to be proven to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. This is the fact of a prior conviction.
Right. And I'm not quibbling with the prior conviction part so much as I'm quibbling with the level of sentencing. Because again, you know, it's the fine range for the first is, you know, a few hundred dollars, you know, a minimum to maximum IDRC, a minimum to maximum, a minimum to maximum suspension, interlock devices, things like that. There's actually no way to deviate from that by statute. Apprendi was more about deviating from a maximum minimum, deviating beyond a maximum, which is just not something you can do with.
Apprendi said, fact of prior conviction can come in, don't even need beyond a reasonable doubt. Just need preponderance of the evidence, fact of prior conviction. That's it.
Well, and I understand that. And again, I'm less quibbling about that part. Although I will say that, and I go back to the point that I made about, you know, you don't have a clear record of conviction anymore because during that time period, you had, you know, a number of cases that were not accurate.
You do have a clear record of conviction. The issue is that nobody has ever attacked the prior conviction in any proceeding, like a PCR, a motion to correct an illegal sentence. That's never happened. As you stood before the court on a second DUI, he had a prior conviction.
Correct.
Nothing happened after that to undermine or undo the prior conviction.
Well,
now we're sitting here deciding whether should we send it back for that process? And the state has explained, and Judge Fall found, that no, because there's nothing to attack it on.
Well, I disagree on two points. One, I go back to 802c8. We did have reason to believe that there was an issue with the public record. There was a significant fraud perpetrated on the state.
Didn't try to attack the public record in any actual proceeding about that prior conviction, right? I think that was Justice Solomon's point, that the fact of a prior conviction was proven. You could attack that prior conviction for filing a PCR, but you did not do so. And so the prior conviction continues to stand. And if you think that it's unreliable for some reason, you can attack it, and then it can be vacated, and then there won't be a prior conviction anymore. But while there is, that's all that matters.
Right. And I guess I disagree in that, again, I did attack the prior conviction in the sense that they tried to offer a public record, and the public record under 802c8, there was significant hearings held and an entire, decision of this court saying that there was problems potentially with thousands of convictions.
But that's why this court lengthened the time in which someone could file a PCR. This court did not just go ahead and expunge all of those convictions or say all of those convictions no longer exist. This court lengthened the five-year period in which someone could file a PCR to attack the conviction. And that was never done here.
Right. And again, two things. One, I could say that among the people who do this work, we didn't necessarily see it that way. There's obviously the court would address, and what the court meant, you obviously know more well than I do what the court meant, but how it was perceived was by many, and certainly by myself, was that, of course, you would address the PCR question. These kind of cases would give rise to a significant number of PCRs. So you do absolutely have to address that particular mechanism, but it still doesn't address the issue with the burden of proof of using something that doesn't necessarily hold up anymore as a piece of proof.
It sounds like you're arguing two different strands, and I want to make sure that I'm not mistaking this. One, that the state utterly failed at the beginning to introduce any evidence of the first conviction, and you've suggested that the record is muddy about that. And two, that what they introduced was not reliable, was not trustworthy, which it appears Judge Fall's findings undermine because of what we've already covered.
Well, I understand.
There are obviously general concerns with reliability, but in this particular case, as Justice Wainwright went through, it was an ALCO test instrument that ends in 0042 that was not calibrated by Dennis.
Right.
So which one are you advancing? Which claim?
I would say both, but I disagree. It's in my papers. I read Judge Fall to indicate that it's something that could have been properly done. The state could have met its burden at that time with the proper evidence. The way I've been sort of speaking about it, we all may have watched Woody Woodpecker when we were kids, and that episode where it said, if Woody had only gone straight to the police, none of this would have happened. If the state had only done this, we wouldn't all be here.
Tell us your experience, and Mr. Gold can help as well. When it comes to sentencing,
yes.
What typically happens in court? Is there a formal proffer of the abstract? Is it stickered and introduced, or is it just referred to, or something else altogether?
So I think if there's not an issue, as it with any trial, if you have an issue that nobody disagrees upon, then you obviously don't waste the court's time. You will often stipulate in something about which the parties don't disagree. Obviously, the vast majority of these cases are resolved by plea, in which case, often you check it on a screen, you get a copy in discovery, and this is the way it is, and we've decided to resolve it at this, in this manner. The court is typically more concerned with how you got to that plea including, you know, particularly if you're not using a reading for some reason, that there's some defect in the ALCA test such that you're going to do a lower tier, you know, a non-reading, usually in the first offenses where, you know, a non-reading could significantly help you. I think it's like any court in that regard. If it's not contested, it's something the parties can usually stipulate to. But in this case, obviously, you know, we had a differing opinion as to the value of, that information.
Understood. Anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
I did want to say that it seems that two things. Judge Fall, again, my reading of the report was is that the notice at the time, up to the, at the time that we were litigating this matter, was not adequate for people to understand that they may be affected by this case. There was a lot of issues with the mailing. There was some issues with the lists.
Was your client harmed by any of that?
My client was harmed. And, well, I suppose
in a perfect world, he wouldn't have been on any of the lists of people entitled to notice. Correct.
That's true. But again, the point I make in bringing this up is that it seems that there's agreement. I might be wrong, between, you know, my position, Judge Fall's position, even the state's position, that there needs to be a notice at the time of trial. That also did not happen, and the major reason for that is most of these cases, you know, if you've gotten a DUI and you have no, you know, no subsequent DUI, you've paid your fine, it's a few hundred dollars, you've served your suspension, you've spent your time in the IDRC. Realistically speaking, the best you could hope for is to get your money back. And you'll often, you know, unless you qualify for a public defender, you know, you're going to pay an attorney to do that unless you can figure out how to do it yourself and spend that time. So realistically speaking, the notice, sending sort of blanket notices out, while it's probably legally required, and it's something we should definitely do, because some people might, for whatever reason, find it in their interest to undo a conviction that maybe was not wrongfully held. The first time that most of these people are going to see the need to do something about this is at the time of trial. And even the suggestion that the state seems to, if I understood them properly in their presentation, is at the time of trial, we'll hand you a piece of paper. Whether that's the right way to do it, I'll leave that to the Bar Association to cover. But the time to notify the defendant, even if we're going to have them do a PCR, is at the time of trial when it most affects them. And so, you know, he didn't get a notification, but that was the basis by which, that was one of the bases by which the state argued that they had met their burden, was that, well, you know, if you hadn't gotten a letter, that means that you weren't affected. It might have turned out that way, but that's not actually true. And also, it seems like we're going down the road of doing the PCRs, not at the same time of trial, but around the time of the trial, the second or the subsequent DUI.
Don't read answers into the questions. And that might be a good place for us to stop, if that's all right.
One thing I did want to bring up, I apologize, but I did have the court did ask the state, you know, their opinion on whether or not
please answer whatever it is and bring your argument to a close.
Yes. So I, as the court might know, most of the judges are part-time. Some have multiple courts. The prosecutors tend to be part-time. I'm not sure that if the court, I don't think it would be an enormous problem with having the trial court do it in some sort of bifurcated fashion. By it, I mean the PCR to deal with the prior if that comes up. There's logistical reasons I'm sure that could be worked out. I'm sure some judges might have an issue, and some prosecutors might have an issue, but generally speaking, it's a work volume issue, and I don't know that they matter. It matters.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Mr. Gold.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. If I may, I'd like to just go over 6 points real quick, like bullet points, so you can see the whole of what our position is. It's all in our briefs, but this would be the bullet point version on one piece of paper. The case is really not about Cassidy and whether it really is about the burdens and discovery in municipal court when you have an extra element of an offense to prove. That's why I think Mr. Cook is talking about it like a trial, because in Apprendi, yes, Apprendi says that when it is a just a sentencing issue, then it's preponderance. But that's not all we have here. What we have is a period of time when the appellate division and Judge Fall both said during this period of 8 years approximately, whether that conviction is something a court should rely on is subject to question. It's not just a business record. It's not just something that is printed out on the bench. And I think that the answer to the question about how it works, there's a statute that says a judge has to run it in municipal court. I wasn't thinking about it till the question, but there's a statute that says judge gets the abstract, can't sentence without doing it. But so what does Apprendi say? It says, well, if you want to increase the punishment, yes, we're talking about that. We're talking about increasing the punishment. Then it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt unless it's just merely a prior record. But we don't have just merely a prior record. We have a prior record that the court, as the gatekeeper of evidence, has to make sure is not tainted by malfeasance. Mark Dennis is in prison as we speak for, you know, his deeds. He wasn't when we did Cassidy in 2018. I was here. He wasn't. That was yet to be determined during Cassidy. So that's the Apprendi part of it. So it's the time period when somebody walks into court and the judge looks at an abstract. I'll let Mr. Cook, you know, argument sit for that. But when the judge sees the abstract, if it's during that time period, both the appellate division and Judge Fall said, we know that if it was Dennis, he has falsely certified statements in that case, if it was Dennis.
You say that's the Apprendi piece of it, but Apprendi doesn't actually say anything about a prior conviction not possibly not being reliable, correct? It just says prior conviction proved by preponderance of the evidence. That's it.
It does say that, but my brief is replete with all the special things we ought to do, whether we're prosecutors, defense lawyers, or court, when we know of possible malfeasance.
Understood, but those special things are not grounded in Apprendi, correct? Apprendi doesn't say anything about when a prior conviction might be less reliable, more reliable, what a court would have to do to ensure reliability at all.
That is correct. But we have to assume it just because it would make no sense to say there's a lower burden for something we already know during that time period is subject to question.
You heard Ms. DAG Oberholzer's discussion about S-152, I think I got it right, and the confidentiality issues that it presents in its current format. What is your response and what solutions to that problem can you suggest?
Easy, and it's in the brief. First of all, let's look at what Judge Fall did with 152. He talked about at the trial, which I'm still adopting that trial rather than sentencing justice because it's an element, it's an extra element. That at that date, the state has an extra burden beyond a reasonable doubt, which can be satisfied by reference to S-152, which he then said the defense should be entitled to verify, go back and look independently. So that's an important point because the Attorney General's position is they'd like this to be a secret. Now, maybe that's not the right word for it, but we're only here because we weren't able to test the other lists and whatever else in the ad.
Let me ask you a preliminary question.
Yes.
Do you I'm not asking if you agree to it, but do you dispute the assertions of the state that there are third-party confidentiality issues, personal identifying information, information that should not be publicly available on that database, whatever the correct term for it is, as it now stands?
Okay. We did make a suggestion, which is in the brief, that we can alleviate this like that. You simply delete the personal identifiers in the S-152, all of them, just like they are deleted in the Alcatest inquiry system, which has been published since, you know, after Chun. So that's the way it is now. All we have to do is do the same thing with this spreadsheet.
But then how do you find the defendant?
That was the missing piece from the discussion before. The AOC municipal website portal, I think is what we call it, run by the AOC. If I put in one of your names, I can find your tickets right now. If I had your drivers, I could do the same thing. Okay, so this is the way it works in practice. You get an abstract. Abstract doesn't tell me a summons number, so that's not good enough. But if I have the abstract, I know where it happened. I can go to the AOC website and get the summons number. The summons number is not one of those personal identifiers that gets deleted. It's in the AIS right now for every Alcatest case there ever was. So by using the portal, we link the redacted 152 to the actual connection. That's how it's done.
Then isn't that the same as the other database that you already can search? Oh, so what's the difference?
The AIS is set up where you have to go to a particular machine, and there's 550 approximate machines. So it's not like Lexis, or you can't just type anything in. You have to go to each machine. And so that's an impossible task. The solution that we've put forth is meant particularly to resolve this in 5 minutes, even if you've done nothing on the day of sentencing. Theoretically, when people get used to it, they'll do this in the beginning of the case. They'll find out if it's a Dennis case or not. Defense attorneys will make their PCRs. But what we have is if you put an index, that's what S-152 is, as is was mentioned before, the repository, which we created, is not by itself that helpful. It gives you the actual evidence of a signed certificate to put into evidence, but you need to have an index. That's what S-152 is.
And that's what has the list of thousands and thousands of names.
But without the names, if you redact it, no name, no driver's license.
So how is it searchable? In the unlikely event that you had to search yourself for this purpose,
a summons number.
Just use your summons number.
Yeah, that's the key, because there's also a case
number. But if your clients don't walk in with their summons number from prior convictions, do they?
No, you not. Remember, let's take it this way. The way a practitioner gets it is prosecutor sends him an abstract and discovers. And this is all about discovery. If you have to think of it as a normal municipal court case, it's about discovery. So you get the abstract. Defense attorney, prosecutor can now go to the porthole and look up that. What is the summons number? Because you have the name, you have the driver's license, you have the other information necessary. And when you get the summons number, it's generally your key. Now, will there be a few that get lost? Yes, but.
So you're saying they should not use names, which I guess I'll.
Well, you asked a question, so I'm kind of taking a step further than I wanted on paper.
Questions, Mr. Bell.
No. You're my pleasure to answer them. No. I do think we, for the bar, that what Judge Fall said for elevating an offense as an element requires the state to provide at sentencing whether it is or is not. And he said they should verify. I'm trying to find ways. We don't have to wait for the last minute. We don't have to postpone cases. We can all know this. As a defense attorney, we want to know that as soon as the client walks in.
I was going to ask you that question. This is usually something that would happen if your client never mentioned a prior offense, and you're going in there assuming you're going to plead out as a first-time offense. Prosecutor says, oh, by the way, your client has another offense. If you're going to take this, it has to be as a second. And now this whole thing starts. But if you could do it just based on the summons number and find that it's within the Dennis category, and then the case gets adjourned for the possibility of deciding whether or not PCR is viable, would that be sufficient to satisfy this issue?
Okay. The way we do it with a redacted one, which has absolutely zero personal identifier issue, because that's exactly the way AIS is, the defense attorney can know in the beginning of a case. The prosecutor can routinely put it to his secretary. It's so easy to do. Send it out in discovery. It is or it isn't a Dennis case. Not wait for the end. That was the whole point of us being involved.
Because the abstract provides the information to get the summons number from the AOC. And the summons number is compared to the S-152, and then you know.
Yes, and we still think that solves Cassidy. Like, in other words, we know that through looking at this case, it wasn't Judge Fall's business, but part of it was to examine what happened in Cassidy. It didn't really work. But if we have the unredacted list up, that's as good notice for anybody who ever had Cassidy over forever. It can be online.
But let me just ask a very simple question. If you were a self-represented person were to access that database with the personal identifiers deleted or not part of the database, you would need a summons number or you would get nothing out of the database.
Yeah, that's going to be the key.
Okay, so a person who is not represented by you, in other words, a less lucky person, who is seeking to do this on their own, is going to have to find their summons number.
Okay, and I haven't.
On the driver's abstract?
Yeah, no, the abstract tells you the when.
Okay.
As was correctly pointed out, sometimes, you know, they were drunk and it was 10 years ago. They don't exactly know. People don't commit exactly where it was or what, but you get the abstract from the prosecutor.
Okay.
Now you go to the public AOC website. Nothing special.
Is this something that a pro se litigant, let me just finish the question. Is this something that a pro se litigant could do?
They absolutely do it. I have defendants call me having looked up their stuff already. It's a public website.
Mr. Gold, they could also walk into a municipal court if they remember where it happened and just say, can you please provide me with a copy of the summons for my arrest?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the issue Judge Fall found about not restricting it too much. You mentioned, Chief Justice, about restricting it to the 27,000 that Donahue first created or allegedly created. We don't really know. But Judge Fall was right. You want to know yes or no, not just a null search. I didn't find him on the list. Who did do it? Where was it? And that's what his list, it'll tell you definitively. And again, the beauty of it is 5 minutes online from the hallway on your phone.
How does the self-represented litigant know about the Dennis issue to begin with?
Well, I mean, there aren't many, you know, but that was the point of notice. No, that was the point of sending letters. We was trying to push it. So there are two issues. What's going on in Zingas on the day of sentencing, and then how do we fix up Cassidy? Those are two separate things. I think this list gets you as far as we'll ever go because there's no way we could do mailings to the other 20% who probably didn't get anything. So it's as good as we're going to get. Most people that are thinking about PCRs already have a case and a lawyer, and they're going to court. Everybody in municipal court for a DWI is represented. You know, I can't even tell you the last time. It had to be 40 years ago. I saw somebody unrepresented for a DWI because that's our mantra. You know, the judges push it. They want them to get lawyers, and they do. And they're entitled to public defenders. That's why I say that this solution is obvious. So,
are they represented on a first offense by a public defender?
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
I've been on a PCR.
You know, the PCR... You know, those are, maybe I digress to not exactly answer that, but say to you that your idea about having the sentencing and the PCR on the same day was recommended by the Supreme Court Municipal Court Committee. And I know because I authored it. It wasn't actually approved at any point.
What's your view on it?
Fine. It's a good idea. Makes it quick. It's exactly right. For prosecutors, they'd like these things to go quickly. For judges, they'd like them to go quickly. And for defense attorneys, we want them to go quickly.
Are there any impediments to it that you see based on your practice in this area?
No, as I say, I authored the rule. It came up and, you know, for whatever reason, wasn't approved here. But no, the committee as a whole recommended that rule. So, you know, it's up to the court to decide, but I don't see a downside. I think it makes perfect sense, actually.
And can I ask you another question? Yes. That came up in the first argument? Most of these cases are resolved by guilty pleas, of course. And if the guilty plea is overturned, you go back and you start anew. The question about whether there was any jeopardy issue related to a trial. Are there trials in your experience where the state only puts in the BAC as opposed to observational evidence as well?
I have to say, they could use new evidence. I agree with the state on that. I also agree with Mr. Cook that in a case where they don't have their case together on the sentencing and trial date, that you can't send it back and get, oh, they didn't put in the murder weapon. Okay, we send them an opinion that says we now know where the murder weapon is. You can have a second trial. No, they're two separate things. But on your question, yeah, they can.
Drill down just a little bit more.
Okay.
In your experience, when these cases go to trial, does the prosecution introduce evidence of both observational evidence, mm-hmm. if it exists, and BAC,
yeah.
or simply the BAC?
No, they do everything. They put everything they have. The reason I say it is that
is off the table as a general proposition.
I could imagine a scenario. You have a key witness who isn't available at the first trial. And it was in Afghanistan 10 years ago. You know, now he's available. I don't know. But I don't think that's a double jeopardy issue. I think if you have a successful PCR and the result of the PCR is to reopen the case, what I do is I try the case now. That's what we're doing. And that's basically what happened at the PCR court with Judge Fall. He didn't try the cases per se, but they were evaluated one by one as to whether or not it could live on its own without a reading or whether Cassidy didn't affect it and it was sent back.
You mean in those 1,200 cases, right?
Now, yes, in the 1,200 of 27,000 cases. So why are only so few? Because most of them do them when they come to sentencing. That's sort of when this happens. It's when, you know, the defendant sometimes, but rarely comes to a defense attorney out of the blue and says, I need to get that off my record. It happens, but they've spent the $5,000 in, you know, fees and things. They've lost their rights. They can never get that 6 months or 7 months back. They come when it matters. Occasionally you have somebody that it matters to, and they do ask you to reopen.
Mr. Gold, we're at the risk of having a municipal court evening proceeding here today. I'll move along a little bit further.
All right.
I don't know how many of your 6 points you've covered, but take five more minutes max, and then let's close down.
So if you look at it as this is about the burden and this is about discovery, you say, who is Mark Dennis? He's somebody who the state has particular knowledge about. He may be involved in the evidence that they're proffering to raise the offense. And there's a discovery rule. This isn't like we're reinventing, you know, in municipal court, it's 777. In criminal cases, 313.3. The state has to turn over evidence at that time, if they want to get it in, of, you know, scientific records. He was involved in the case. Statements we already know. In any case he was in, he signed a certification that is presumptively false. That's what Cassidy is. He said he did something that presumptively he didn't. That's why those readings can't come in. So they must turn that evidence over at sentencing. It's an issue then. And that's the important part about Zingas. Zingas is about what happens at sentence, what's the state's burden, and then it's just discovery, but they can't ignore their discovery. When Mr. Zingas went to court, he had no way to know. Those were secret lists. He didn't have a list to look at. And even then, they wouldn't show him the list. That's what the state is now saying, too. Judge Fall said at the sentencing, tell him if it is or tell him if it isn't Dennis, if it falls in the time period, only those cases. And then the defendant should be able to verify it. So I think, frankly, you could put that up online with a protective order, just like the AOC does, the court does, for all the things as a lawyer, I click through and I certify. I'm a lawyer. The idea that only a certain So I don't agree with that. I agree with Judge Fall. Lawyers, when you're going to give them a protective order, will take it serious. Remember that
But you are arguing that all the personal identifying information should be redacted anyway, correct?
Well, the last part first. That satisfies notice. That rectifies Cassidy. What do we do about that mess? The unredacted up there, good enough for the purposes of noticing once and for all, that's the end of that story. Little different when you have a pending case. Now the prosecutor has a discovery.
Sorry, you're saying that there has to be something up online for everyone that's not redacted? So everyone's personal identifying information is just online?
Well, I wouldn't object to it if it had certification by an attorney and it was only allowed attorneys, municipal prosecutors, judges to go on. Yeah, okay.
Why would they need the unredacted if you were suggesting the redacted version works?
I prefer all the information. It's a little better. But the bar is suggesting workarounds to address the state's complaint. So, yeah, I think Judge Fall is exactly right. And I also think that what Judge Fall means is that the defendant can now verify. And that's really important. And if you just take a look at the history of this, we're in the mess because of secrecy. That was the whole point. If we just had this done in the adversarial system 8 years ago, we would have sorted it out, but we're kind of stuck. So now we want to clean it up, get rid of it. And so I think it's better.
In fairness, it's a unique problem.
It is a unique problem.
And a very complicated problem.
It is absolutely, but these things happen, as you know, sometimes a lab guy, sometimes a police officer, they happen. This is a way to
address. Not daily on an 8-year basis.
And so those are the two remedies. And I also want to address a little bit about BACs. Cassidy was one thing. It was one case about one thing. Defendants have a myriad of facts, circumstances, and they should be able to bring those and litigate those, whatever they are. But the state still has to tell them if Dennis was involved in their case. It's not about the BAC. Sometimes, and this is what the evidence before Judge Fall was, they went to 4 or 5 different courts, jurisdictions, and they took 4 or 5 different tests. Now, we don't know if that's because they were mostly Dennis and they ended up with one that wasn't Dennis, but just think about it in the context. Let's use an example of Miranda. Okay, would we say that the defendant doesn't get to know he was beaten up in this station, beaten up in this station, but he gave a good statement at the last station? He just needs to know what happened in his case. Courts will do what they want with it. Nobody's going to change the law. We haven't asked. The state mentioned something about admissibility. We don't ask you to make any admissibility findings here. But we do point out in our brief that anytime Dennis was involved, that AIR goes into evidence, just like one with a BAC. Even without a BAC, it goes in. The state police procedure is, if you went to 5 courts, or 5 jurisdictions, you're supposed to put all 5 in. And the court has to look at all those. That's solved, though. That issue is solved by simply putting up the unredacted as the index. Let me just see if there's anything else you guys said that I wanted to address. I think you've asked them again to me, which is good. So that's basically it. If you put the unredacted, the redacted up alone next to the repository, case solved.
Thank you, Mr. Polk. Mr. Novick.
Thank you, and may please the court. Representing an agency that does not practice in municipal court and having never litigated the case in municipal court, I'm going to try to avoid the municipal court specific questions, but I'm going to try to help the court work through some of the issues with the framework that we and the state have proposed and some of the issues that we've had. And I do want to focus on the indictable cases, which is why our agency is in this case. So first of all, on a few of the disagreements that we have about the framework that applies, the state takes S-152 in a case where you got a second DWI, your first DWI was during the Dennis time period, and they look in S-152 and see if your case was a Dennis case. One of the issues that came up, and Justice Wiener, after you asked the state about this, is whether they have to provide the actual data from the spreadsheet to defense counsel. And the state has said that they want to provide a prosecutor certification. Our view is that they should definitely provide the actual underlying data. Part of the reason we're here in the first place is that the state had this list that no one had access to other than the state. And when the list came to the light of day in front of Judge Fall, and very much credit to Judge Fall for allowing discovery about how the list was created and so on and so forth, it turns out the list was inaccurate. The actual data is what's important. This is the way courts should work, that you rely on the actual evidence and the actual data. It should go in front of the court, be disclosed to counsel, and be litigated that way.
And what does that mean?
For S-152, right, because obviously, so there's obviously lots of confidential information in S-152 for third parties, but if the state has a lot of confidential. So if the state has, so I go in for my second DWI, which is a hypothetical scenario, I promise you, and they find my name in S-152 for my first DWI, I want them to send me the row of the Excel spreadsheet with the actual data. I don't want a prosecutor certification.
That she meant. You're talking about all the different columns that your adversary
correct.
Had to track, but
correct.
Still only the one row.
Only for me, because that's my information. So now you're not disclosing any confidential information from a third party to me. That's what I want. There's a few reasons for that. Number one is I can double check that information with either the unredacted version of the spreadsheet that goes online, which I'm supportive of if the court goes that route, or if the court does not go that route, I can now check the public AIS and make sure the data there matches up with the state with what the state gave me. It's just a verification tool.
And is that something that can be done with the current technology, or would there have to be a change to what the status of this database, how it's organized, what's there?
So again, I've never actually run a search on the public AIS, so I may be the wrong person to ask that question to.
I'm talking about the spreadsheet.
The spreadsheet. Well, right now I'm just talking about the spreadsheet maintained by the state.
Right.
So you're okay with the state just highlighting the one row and sending it over?
Correct.
That's it.
I'm okay with that.
So that should be technologically possible now, because all you need to do is highlight the row and email it over.
Correct. And I understand it is many rows. I've looked at these spreadsheets many times. There's a lot of columns. Sorry. There's lots of columns of my information, rows of other people's information, but columns of my information.
The answer to Justice Patterson's question? You've got 237,000 or so entries, 30 columns for each. Is there a way to extract that one 30 column entry?
Sure. I mean, you could do it in technological ways and you could do it in non-technological ways. It's an Excel spreadsheet. You could copy the row and paste it into another spreadsheet and send it to me. You could print it out. These spreadsheets are really hard to print out, but you could print out the page that is on and redact all of the other rows on the spreadsheet that are not my information and send it to me. Okay. I think either of those is acceptable. I don't believe this is requiring any sort of advanced technological issue, because we're not putting it online for the public to search. For an individual to search that spreadsheet is really easy. Excel has all sorts of sorting tools and searching tools and so on and so forth. But there is a complication that hasn't come up yet today that is important, which is that the AIS is fallible in many ways. And that is mainly because the person who takes the breath test is the person who enters the information into the machine for many of the columns. Some of the columns are populated by the machine, like the serial number and the calibration date that you were reading off earlier that Judge Fall pulled for Mr. Zingas's case, but a lot of them are put in manually and people make mistakes. If you look in these AIS spreadsheets and you search for the number four, just an entry with the number four, you find a lot of them. There's some error in the system that if you hit the wrong button, it populates your field with the number four. Right. So the state could be looking for my case and they could look for my last name, Novak, and they might not be able to find it because for some reason that field is a four. Right. And I don't know that. And everybody and a lot of other people are fours. So this happens also. I'm a little concerned.
Sound all that smooth.
It is and it isn't. I think there's ways around this that I'm trying to get to, but I want the court to understand exactly, having spent a lot of time in these spreadsheets, what you're getting yourself into. Because I do hate to contradict Mr. Gold, who I agree with about 99% of what he said.
He's also number four, by the way.
But his complaint number that he's looking for in the spreadsheet might be a number four. So if the operator enters the complaint number, if they make a mistake, and it's not always just a number four, they could transpose digits, they could make a typo, something else could happen. And Justice Noriega, you asked whether we could make the database searchable, just print out the arrest date. like a range of arrest dates for you. The arrest dates aren't always correct. This came up in a very specific way in the hearing at 9T, page 77 to 79, where the arrest date for the person was before the calibration date of the Alka-Test machine, which of course makes no sense because you got tested on the Alka-Test machine after it was calibrated. They had the month off by one, right? It was the arrest date said April 14th and the calibration for the Alka-Test machine said May 10th, but the arrest date was supposed to be May 15th, not April 15th. So these types of mistakes happen. And this leads to, I think, one of the big issues in the case is what happens if the state looks in the spreadsheet and says, we can't find you. We had this come up in the hearing. This is, I don't want to say the person's name because I don't think it's fair to them to do it in the public hearing, but this is in the briefs. There was someone who filed a PCR in front of Judge Fall. The information wound up filtering its way into our hearing. And when we looked for this person's name in the big spreadsheet that's supposed to have all of the Alka-Test breath test results, we could not find the name. We couldn't find the complaint number. We looked around the date of arrest. We couldn't find it. So there are going to be people whose information is missing. I think I heard a concession from the state earlier that they're going to send a form letter to everybody when this comes up, either you are a dentist case or you're not a dentist case. That was something that was not clear in the briefs. I think they asserted the right to just say nothing if it's not a dentist case. But one of our positions is that they should tell you whether or not you are a dentist case when they're searching S-152, because there's the third category of we looked and we couldn't find you. And Justice Wiener, after you asked, does a person have to file a PCR to find out whether there's a dentist case or not? I think this is the category, and I'll admit, I have no idea how large this category is. We identified one person during the hearing. This process obviously hasn't gone forward yet, so it may be a little bit of a unicorn, but I think there might be some cases where when the state looks in S-152, it finds no information that matches, and then you do have to file a PCR to see if the discovery is still available in the municipal court, which often it's not, I will say. It gets destroyed after
a period. In the ordinary course, you shouldn't have to file a PCR to find out if you're a dentist case or not. And the state conceded that they're not arguing that someone has to file a PCR to find out if they're a dentist case.
Correct. But there might be some cases where we don't know and you do have to file a PCR. So there is that category. I just want to make clear our position is that in that kind of third category where we can't find you in the spreadsheet, our position is, you file a PCR, and if the discovery has been destroyed, we think you get the benefit of getting your conviction vacated, which does not mean that the case gets dismissed, they could retry it, whatever. But if you can't find out what happened in the municipal court case, and it's not on the AIS to show that you weren't a dentist case, this is the state's database, this was the state's employee, the benefit should not inure to the state of it not being able to find your information at the end of the day.
Mr. Novick, you've heard the back and forth as to whether PCR should go to the original court, or if the sentencing court can handle both matters. What's your view and why?
So I was getting to that, and I don't really have a strong view, just not being in municipal courts and not knowing exactly what the logistical burdens are of municipal court two in the second DWI case, trying to litigate a PCR from municipal court one. But I do have one scenario in which I think it can all be handled in one court, and that's that I do think the state
can or cannot.
I should try to speak more slowly and clearly. One situation in which it can be handled in the second court, and I think that's where the state says either we looked at your S-152 information and we found that you are a dentist case, or we could not find you, that the state in the second case could say, we want to move forward today, and we'll concede that you can get sentenced as a first-time offender. We won't seek the enhancement.
Yes, but in cases where the enhancement is being sought, can you identify a harm to the defendant by having a consolidated proceeding?
To be perfectly candid, I don't think the harm is to the defendant. I think the harm is to the state and the prosecuting entity in case one that might want to be able to have its interests heard, since it is a different municipality, a different court, different evidence, different police department, all of that stuff. So I don't think there's a harm to the defendant. I think the issue is whether this, given the kind of fractured nature of the municipal court system, whether that would work in practice. And I don't have an opinion on it not being in municipal courts.
Please go ahead. And if I could ask you to try to...
I know, I'm trying. Covered that. Okay, so...
Ask you a question. Given the fact that you're in Superior Court, do you have a position on whether or not the state attempting to introduce the first offense, whether that whether there's a burden involved on the state, what that burden is, and whether or not it's an element or whether it's simply an enhancement.
Yeah. So this goes to Justice Wiener-Apter's questions about Apprendi too. I don't think this is really an Apprendi issue, but I think the thesis behind Apprendi's exception for criminal convictions, which has been widely criticized, is that it's obvious whether you were convicted or not. And in these cases, it is obvious whether you were convicted or not, but there's something else going on here that I don't think we can just turn a blind eye to, which is the state introduced in many cases evidence that this court later found to be inadmissible. So I don't think you need to use the Apprendi frame to resolve the issue, but I think it would be an error to say that Apprendi does resolve the issue, if that makes some amount of sense. There's you have to look at the reason behind the rule, and I don't think the reason behind the normal Apprendi, we just introduce the conviction and that's the end of the day, rule applies here. So I'm not advocating for a higher standard than preponderance. I think that there's no one's argued that in this case to overrule the Apprendi exception line of cases. But I do think the court should be careful about just saying, as long as the state has introduced the evidence of a conviction without more in a DWI case that falls within this time frame, that it's in the clear. So with the time in mind, I do want to turn to the reason we're here, which is we were invited by the court to participate in the case, and we decided to do so and invest time and resources in the case because there are some indictable issues that get affected by these cases. And most of these are actually what we've been talking about today a lot is someone who comes into court tomorrow or the day after this court's opinion is issued in this case with an issue that needs to get resolved under some framework. But a lot of second DWIs, or more to our point, indictable consequences of a prior DWI are cases that have already been resolved, right? You could have had a DWI in 2010 that was a Dennis case before we knew about Dennis. And then the big subsequent consequence that we've talked about is the 4026 prosecution for driving with a suspended license for DWI in 2013, again, before we knew about Dennis, and been convicted of that and have kind of resolved all of that before Cassidy ever comes up, the Cassidy issue ever comes up.
Mr. Nova, perhaps this will streamline it a little bit. Tell us what you need and what you will not be getting under the framework that Judge Fall had laid out.
Right. So we asked Judge Fall to ask the AOC to send us information about certain convictions. And I didn't want to read it. It's on pages 33 to 34 of our brief. Cases where there was a 4026 prosecution within a certain time frame, after, actually to the present, really, because that way we can check if any of those cases might have been a Dennis, the predicate DWI to prosecute a 4026 might have been a Dennis case. And then some, I guess I would call them primary cases, cases that are indictables that are things like assault by auto that you could have maybe had your assault by auto case prosecuted in part based on a Dennis tainted breathalyzer, Alcotest.
We understand the categories of cases you're concerned about. What is it that you need that Judge Fall did not provide for?
Well, Judge Fall didn't order the AOC to provide us with anything. We made the request of Judge Fall, and he noted it in the report, but he didn't.
Right, tick off for us what you need is my question.
Oh, so I can tick it off. It's in our brief.
Was it a list of all individuals convicted of reckless vehicular homicide, assault by auto, or fourth degree driving while license is suspended between 2008 and 2017?
Yes, except for the third category, the indictable 4026, we asked for that through the present, because you could have had one. The 2017 cutoff was based on the idea that your case probably would have been resolved by then if it was a Dennis Alcotest that was used to actually prosecute you in the primary case. But the subsequent consequence in the 4026 that was based on a prior Dennis DWI was something that could have happened. You know, it could be a continuing consequence. So that's what we asked for. The idea would be that we would be able to use that list to identify clients of ours who might have been affected by Dennis and try to reach out to them and help them with their various PCR proceedings. One more ask, our conviction integrity unit was a little bit concerned that when you file a PCR in the Superior Court, say you have a 4026 prosecution, you went to the municipal court, You got the predicate DWI vacated. You come back to Superior Court. You file a PCR on your 4026 saying, I should get this vacated now too because my DWI that this was based on was vacated. They were a little concerned that courts might bounce those based on the time bar before counsel gets assigned. So Cassidy explicitly lifted the time bar on DWIs. We would just ask for something similar for those 4026s so that the courts know when they come in that they shouldn't get bounced for the time bar and that counsel should be assigned.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Oberholzer, brief rebuttal.
I'm going to very briefly address the last issue first. We reached out to the AOC and they do not take a position on the PG's request and asked us not to. But as far as the time bar on the subsequent convictions, I would think the clock would start to run on them when the Dennis convictions was vacated. I would certainly think the court could make that clear, but I think that would be the triggering event. So they would have 5 years from that date to file a PCR. I did reach out to our municipal prosecutor supervising unit during lunch and talked to them about the issue of consolidating the issues in the second jurisdiction. They did explain what some of the logistical problems with that might be. Most municipal prosecutors, not all of them, but most of them are part-time. They have their own practices. Sometimes they cover more than one municipality, and the logistics of them, you know, prosecuting cases in yet an additional municipality, possibly in another county, are not necessarily minor. They also don't usually have offices where they could keep a list that somebody could come look at. They have, you know, they work out of their law firm or their private practice office. So they don't have, there's no municipal prosecutor's office in those counties where the public
could
come see.
You mean there's no place to put a,
right,
some sort of,
right,
computer terminal where somebody,
right, there's search, nowhere for the public to come see a list.
What that, you're assuming in that answer, or the person who gave it to you, is that prosecutor two would not be able to fulfill the role of prosecutor one?
Prosecutor two, so as far as, you know, well, there's a jurisdictional issue with that. Municipal prosecutors are only authorized to prosecute cases arising in their municipality. So, I mean, this court would have to take that into consideration and either specially authorize it or they'd have to be sworn in to handle the cases. And then there's the very real possibility that if we're relying only on observation evidence, it's not just the records that need to be moved, but it's law enforcement officers who need to cross county lines, sometimes over not insignificant distances. As far as the somehow making S-152 a different kind of searchable database that would not reveal more information than the state is comfortable with, even if that's feasible and even if it's financially feasible, and I simply don't know, that's not something anybody's consulted IT about.
I thought Amiki's suggestion wasn't turning it into a database. I thought that had been the court's suggestion. I thought Amiki's suggestion was just you take the Excel spreadsheet, you delete all the identifying information, and then you just post it on the web. So
no, these are questions I discussed at lunch. This is in response to Justice.
Okay. I caused the trouble.
Even if it's doable, S-152 is ready to go now. If this court ordered us to distribute that and have that be used by the counties and the AOC now,
public,
that if that's what this court ordered, that could happen tomorrow.
What about Amiki's suggestion that you take S-152, you delete all the personally identifying information, and then you put it on the web?
Then I don't know why they're not just using the AIS. That's already on the web.
They explained why it was different.
It doesn't have names in it.
The AIS doesn't have names in it either. But
he still explained why it was better. I don't recall exactly.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure either.
I think the discussion was if you have your abstract, you have the summons number, you can put the summons number in, and that's how you find it. Nevertheless, and at the point at which someone would be looking for that information, they would have their summons number. But what was the, I'm sorry, can we go back to the response with regard to S-152, that it's ready to go, but it's ready to go in a form that the state doesn't want it to go.
Right. If the court accepted our suggestion that S-152 be used by the courts and the municipal prosecutor liaisons in the counties, that list exists and it's ready to go. If we were to try at this point to convert it into some sort of a database that could be searched and only bring up one result, assuming that was even feasible, I don't know how long that would take. Now, I am not an Excel expert. I do not know if it's possible to turn a single line of 30 columns into a, you know, print, copy and paste just that line of information.
I don't even
every time I try and search something in Excel, I end up just sorting by
like a row. You can copy and paste it.
But that we could certainly do, is if that's doable, just copy and paste that information into a separate document and provide that information as opposed to the certification.
Just in terms
sorry,
of,
and so on the S-152, sorry, with all the personal identifying information deleted, you don't actually have an issue with posting that online. You just think it would be not.
We do. We with the personal information. Well,
all the personal information.
With the information deleted. Well, it bypasses the paywall for the AIS, which this court has already found is reasonable in Chun 2 when it was the fee was challenged. And
it's not bypassing the paywall in general, it's just for this specific.
It's just for the 8.5 year period, which is a fairly significant portion of it. And that fee pays for the maintenance of the AIS. So if we're bypassing it for a huge portion of the AIS, I'm not sure where the funding is going to come from for maintaining that database that this court has ordered funding. And there may be a contract issue, but that's I don't have an answer to that, whether that's a breach of our contract with. We're basically recreating a large portion of the AIS and making it free and bypassing the contractual fee with our outside vendor. That money doesn't go to the state. It goes to the outside vendor to maintain the AIS. I might go back to Mr. Cook's point about the burden of proof and his argument that the abstracts are not reliable under 802C. The abstract itself is a reliable business record because the conviction, the record of the conviction is still a reliable business record. An abstract doesn't become unreliable because there's some reason that the conviction may be vulnerable to being overturned on appeal or PCR or federal habeas or whatever the circumstances might be. The abstract itself is still a reliable business record. And to answer the court's questions about what happened here, it's on page 3 of the municipal court proceedings. In this case, the state did have the abstract at trial. It does not look like it was ever actually moved into evidence, but there was no objection to that. And defendant didn't argue below that we didn't prove he had a prior conviction, just that we didn't prove it wasn't a Dennis affected conviction. But we did, the screen capture was of the, I think the search that returned no results of S90, which was the list, the original list. And then we also, the municipal prosecutor also represented to the court that it was a Camden County prosecution, which is on the abstract, and that Dennis never calibrated any machines in Camden, which the municipal court judge took notice of. So that was the evidence before the municipal court judge. Brady and the rules of discovery do not require the state to provide inculpatory evidence that a existing conviction is still valid. We are required to provide exculpatory evidence that would undermine the validity of an existing conviction at sentencing, which is providing notice that it's a Dennis conviction. We of course feel that we have an obligation to let them know, defendants know under the circumstances whether they are or were not. But whether that's informally or in a formal document, we don't have an obligation under the currently existing rules to establish by any set standard that you're not a Dennis defendant. And we certainly established here, we informed defendant on the record that he wasn't a Dennis defendant, and not only because he wasn't on the list, but because he wasn't in an affected county. That met our burden really properly, even under the preponderance standard. And certainly the beyond a reasonable doubt standard isn't in any of the documents that the court relied on. The order from Judge Lisa did not require beyond a reasonable doubt standard, just that we search the records and let them know, provide them documentation, which we did. There wasn't any documents to show because there was no record and there were no calibration records showing Dennis calibrated. So
but not quite everything. Go ahead.
I wanted to just briefly address.
You would like to bring the argument to a
close. I understand that. Just two more points. The argument about refusals and any prior test results prior to the final one being relevant because Dennis may have calibrated those. I think the argument is if they go through a lot of test result tests that fail and ultimately refuse on, say, the third machine, that's somehow relevant. Judge Fall found that nothing done in the calibration process would cause a machine to fail, and nothing in the implied consent statute gives you the right to refuse if, say, you just get frustrated because you've been tested too many times. So
let's go to your next argument.
My next point is just this argument that nothing, that somehow Dennis's conviction changes the playing field from Cassidy, is a red herring. Dennis was actually not convicted of anything involving the calibration of the machines. He was convicted for stealing his police ID and using it to get out of traffic tickets,
which had nothing to do with the calibration.
Nothing to do with this. He is serving time for that. I do feel like I need to address the issue of the one person who is not in S-152. We don't know what the situation is. He may not have given an ALCA test, but I think that needs to work its way out in that case and what the circumstances
I think we're good.
Is. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you to all counsel.